Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Brought to you by Capital One, where you can open a savings account in about 5 minutes and earn five times the national average. Just imagine, five times more savings toward that overdue home addition. Maybe even an addition on that addition. This is Banking Reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One and a member FDIC.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Monday, the 25th of November, these are our main stories. Pro-democracy candidates are on course for an emphatic victory in district elections in Hong Kong. The result is a humiliation for the territory's pro-Beijing chief executive. The former Republican mayor of New York, Michael Bloomberg, has confirmed he will seek the Democratic presidential nomination. Also in this podcast, leaked documents show the reality of life inside China's network of prison camps for Uyghur Muslims.
It's about indoctrinating people, so they really have to change their beliefs, their behaviour and the language they speak. It's got to be Mandarin.
Thousands of sheep are feared drowned in a maritime accident in the Black Sea and...
Only by putting in some regulations in this place and tweaking the way technology works in this place that we can actually switch the web to becoming a more constructive place.
Tim Berners-Lee, the inventor of the World Wide Web, setting out his planned contract for the web. Thousands of people were out on the streets of Hong Kong on Sunday, not to do battle with the police, but to cast their votes in district council elections.
Please cast your votes in the next 10 minutes. Please go to the poll station.
Opposition parties were hoping that the poll would reflect public anger with Chief Executive Carrie Lam after months of increasingly violent protests against her administration. Pro-Beijing parties hoped that voters, frustrated by months of unrest, would back their candidates. So which side did voters choose? Before the full results were known, we spoke to our correspondent Stephen McDonnell, who's in Hong Kong.
This is a thumping result for the pro-democracy camp, for those who have been backing the protesters, and a virtual wipeout for candidates supporting the government of Carrie Lam and indirectly Beijing. I mean, the last set of numbers I saw, I mean, the count's still coming in, was 286 to 34. I mean, nobody expected such a comprehensive smashing of the establishment here. Sure, we have seen a big turnout. I mean, this is the largest participation rate Hong Kong has ever seen in an election. And I think it just shows the level of feeling here. And I think people, I suppose, had decided that we've seen so much violence, so much tension here, to come out and try the ballot box. Now, these are district council elections. And, you know, so you're voting supposedly on local issues, the sort of things district councils will be dealing with. But instead, it was interpreted as something of a referendum on Carrie Lam's administration and the way it's handled this crisis now in its sixth month. And I should add that these elections are kind of the only real elections that we have in Hong Kong, because Carrie Lam, her position, the chief executive, is chosen by this committee stacked with pro-Beijing loyalists. The Legislative Council, the sort of mini parliament in Hong Kong, also half chosen by a committee stacked with pro-Beijing loyalists. And so these local council elections are the only proper elections that we sort of have, if I could put it to you that way. And so for that reason, it's been... Well, people think the result is much more legitimate, and it's also why I think many voters thought it's time to turn out to really send a message to the government here, and they are going to be under a lot of pressure in the coming days to explain why it is they won't adhere to the demands of protesters and why it is that their supporters have been just so comprehensively defeated at the ballot box.
And Stephen, very briefly,
those local councils will have a bit of a say, will they not, in the election of the next chief executive?
Yes, the way it's sort of, I mentioned that the chief executive is chosen by this sort of committee stacked by pro-Beijing loyalists. Well, a proportion of people on that committee are drawn from local councils. And so at least some of those pro-democracy figures will be on that committee. However, it is a kind of complicated way in which they pick people to get on that committee to, well, as I say, to ensure that Beijing can never lose control of it. But although I think it doesn't mean that the pro-democracy forces will be able to choose who they want, they can create sort of headaches for Beijing, if you like, in terms of how they choose and who they choose as their next leader of Hong Kong.
Julian Marshall speaking to Stephen McDonnell in Hong Kong. Leaked documents reveal for the first time how China is running a network of high-security prisons designed to brainwash hundreds of thousands of people. The authorities in Beijing have consistently claimed the camps in the Xinjiang region offer education and training. But official documents leaked to the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists and seen by the BBC's Panorama programme show how inmates are locked up, indoctrinated and punished. China's UK ambassador has denied the BBC's claims. Richard Bilton reports.
The world has seen images of the walls, satellite images of the camps, smuggled pictures of the cells. Now we know what's happening inside. Our document contains orders written for those who run the camps. China might tell the world they offer vocational training. It's not true. The document is clear.
Never allow escapes. Increase discipline and punishment. Full video surveillance, free of blind spots.
Sophie Richardson is from Human Rights Watch.
This is an actionable piece of evidence documenting a gross human rights violation. This should be sitting, you know, in the files of a prosecutor.
The brutality laid out in the documents is recognised by former inmates. Ye Zhan was taken away in the night and held for nearly a year.
They stripped me naked and put chains on my wrists. It was so frightening. They didn't see us as human beings. I didn't think I'd come out of this alive.
His is the story of a million people. In the last 3 years, China has built hundreds of camps across the remote province of Xinjiang. Each has hundreds of inmates, mainly Uyghur Muslims. The Chinese state has let the media in. It says the camps help to stop terrorism and people learn new skills for free. But the document shows the real reason.
Promote repentance and confession. Make remedial Mandarin studies the top priority. Encourage students to truly transform.
A superpower is locking people up until they change their beliefs, their behaviour and their language. Ben Emerson QC is a legal advisor to the World Uyghur Congress.
It's very difficult to view that as anything other than a mass brainwashing scheme designed and directed at an entire ethnic community.
The Chinese ambassador in London, Liu Xiaoming, refused to answer our direct questions about the camps.
Good morning.
Last week, he called a press conference about Hong Kong.
My name is Richard Bilton. I'm a reporter for BBC.
But I wanted to know about the camps of Xinjiang.
I know that they are prison camps. Why won't you tell me the truth about those camps?
First of all, I would say there's no so-called labour camps, as you describe. There's what we call vocational education and training centres. They are there for the prevention of a terrorist.
With respect, sir, what you're telling me bears no relation to what I've seen.
What the so-called document you're talking about is a pure fabrications. Don't listen to fake news. Don't listen to fabrications.
The documents are not fake news. They're evidence of crimes against humanity. China is caging hundreds of thousands of people in brainwashing camps. And now we know how.
Richard Bilton. In an already crowded field, the former Republican mayor of New York, Michael Bloomberg, has confirmed he will seek the Democratic presidential nomination for next year's US election. The billionaire media magnate had previously said that he wouldn't run for president in 2020. I asked our Washington correspondent Chris Buckler what changed Mr. Bloomberg's mind.
Well, he always indicated that he would only join the race if he felt that none of the Democrats currently running could beat Donald Trump. So you have to bear that in mind. Perhaps the idea that he thinks they don't currently have what it takes to beat Donald Trump. And certainly there have been polls recently that have suggested that in some of those very important areas where Donald Trump won in 2016, some of the Democrats are struggling. But if you look at the adverts that he's just launched as well, it is clear it is about President Trump as well. He describes him at one point as a menace and says there are unprecedented risks if Donald Trump gets back into the White House.
But when he was mayor of New York, he was a Republican.
Yeah, but he was a Democrat before that, and he's flipped again. And in fact, at one stage during the last number of years, it was suggested that he might even think about running as an independent. But he's back on the Democratic ballot, and he is determined to do what he can to try and see if he can win this. Now, the problem for him is it's an incredibly crowded field, but he does have a couple of things in his favour. First of all, he's got his record as New York City mayor, where he was pretty popular. He's got name recognition, and also he's got wealth. Because this is an expensive business, trying to become president of the United States. His ad campaign just to announce that he's running cost some $30 million. But of course, that's just a drop in the ocean for this multi-billionaire.
Do we know what Donald Trump thinks of Michael Bloomberg?
Well, he insists he's not scared of him, but certainly he doesn't seem to like him. In fact, he said at one stage that nothing give him more idea of potential satisfaction of beating little Michael, as he calls him. Although, frankly, it's all getting personal, even at this early stage. I'll quote Michael Bloomberg here. He says that Donald Trump is a failed businessman whose companies went bankrupt multiple times and who built a presidential campaign around empty promises. You get the impression that the fight is only just beginning.
Two elderly white billionaires.
Yeah, and I think that matters for the Democrats. It is worth pointing out that just a week ago, before this announcement, Michael Bloomberg made a point of apologising for supporting what was known as a stop-and-frisk policy in New York City whenever he was mayor. Basically, that was the police in a position where they searched people and it disproportionately affected black and Latino people. Now, at the end of the day, they will be important voters for the Democrats, and it gives you the sign that he needs to get them on board.
Chris Buckler. Sir Tim Berners-Lee, the inventor of the World Wide Web, will set out a contract for the web at a conference in Berlin on Monday. It's an attempt to bring governments, companies and individuals together to shape a better future for the online world. Sir Tim admitted that countries such as China and Russia were unlikely to sign up and also conceded that the United States might have reservations. But as he told our technology correspondent Rory Kethlen-Jones, he's long believed that such a contract was needed.
Early on, it was blocking. It was simple, because blocking, you can see, wow, in China, you can't get to Google. But then we realised that countries where the spying can be worse than blocking, if they let you go to the website and spy on the fact that you do, and then find out all who all your friends and acquaintances are, and then arrest you all in the middle of the night, that's actually kind of more ghastly. And then came the fake news wave, where I think a lot of people with the 2016 elections, suddenly there was a realization that both deliberate manipulation of the electorate in very subtle ways, using targeted advertising based on information which had been taken ostensibly for research purposes, being used for very different purposes.
Now, you've put these nine key principles together.
Well, we've got these nine principles, so basically three for governments, three corporations, say for people. Those are the framework, and over the last year, all the people who involved have sat down in working groups, and they have figured out, okay, if we're really going to, when we're going to look at tricky things like hate speech and bullying, solving that is not something a government can just do or a company can just do, but if governments and companies sit down and work out where to draw the line, who's responsible for what. You know, we're not going to have one party defining what true is. We're not going to have one party defining what's hateful or not. We're going to have a process. And that's what's been powerful about this, because they have had, over the last year, really useful discussions. And so then we end up with these recipes, which are now hard, concrete things. And governments know that if they proceed down this path, then they've also got commitments from companies proceeding down their part and doing their part. And it's only by doing these all these things together, by putting in some regulations in this place and tweaking the way technology works in this place, that we can actually switch the web to becoming a more constructive place.
As far as I understand it, as of now, you haven't got any governments actually signed up to this process.
We don't expect people to sign up straight away at all. Because they're governments. Governments work have to work by, on a good day, by democratic processes. They will meet. They will need to look at it. The final draft of the wordings has only just come out. It would be great if in a couple of years' time we have a whole bunch of governments. 20, 30 governments will be great.
The US government, under the current administration, is dead opposed to one of the key things that you care about, net neutrality. The open web. They're never going to sign up to this, are they?
I don't imagine that they will. The current administration hasn't shown any interest in signing up for these sorts of principles, and as you say, it's actively tried to roll back net neutrality, although that may still be in the courts. But mind you, there are elections coming up in a number of countries, and so one of the things to talk to your candidate about is the contract for the web.
If you summed up the kind of thinking behind a lot of this, it is Western, liberal, open in its principles. Isn't that going to mean that the web does divide, just as you fear?
And it's socially liberal, if you like. Yeah. It doesn't have to be Western. So I hope that we will, certainly really important aspect of the web is it's global. The global south. As we're crossing the 50% line, all the momentum of taking us from 20% when we started the Web Foundation to 50% now has been people in Africa coming online with data plans, hopefully affordable data plans and cell phones. So the global south is becoming a really important amount. Even the people in China have got, there's a limit to what they can do. They are massive users of the web. They're, to a certain extent, China in e-commerce, in using the web to make people's lives more functional, to allow people to trade. China is really is one of the leaders. So the web isn't a Western thing. I think what's possible is that as the other half go online, we'll see perhaps in Africa, for example, and maybe India, a huge number of dialects. People with lots of different dialects become involved. Interesting questions will be, will all the dialects of the world be well represented on the web? When you get online, will you tell everybody, blog in your own language, or will you use your English to chat to all your Facebook friends?
Tim Berners-Lee speaking to the BBC's technology correspondent, Rory Kethlen-Jones. We're in the countdown to Christmas, and that means my colleague Jackie Leonard is busy compiling our special festive season podcast, and she needs your help.
Hello, Jackie here, just reminding you about the Happy News Pod. I want to hear your happiest moments of the year. Just record yourself telling us your name, where you are, and one sentence explaining what was the thing that made 2019 sparkle for you. Then attach it to an email and send it to our normal email address, globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. And while you're at it, perhaps include a photo of yourself, or the view where you listen to the Global News Podcast, or the happy thing itself, or a dog or a kitten or something, I don't know. Quite apart from anything else, it is cheering us up no end here. The Happy News Pod will be available on December the 25th. Thank you all.
British Prime Minister has launched his party's manifesto for next month's general election, promising to get Brexit done. Boris Johnson is hoping for a Conservative majority after the previous Parliament declined to pass his Brexit bill within 3 days.
We're going to get Brexit done. Yeah. With a deal that is pre-cooked, ready to go, approved not just by our friends in the EU, but by every single one of the 635 Conservative candidates standing at this election.
But besides the headline slogan, Mr. Johnson also promised to move away from the austerity policies of the last decade. With the details, our political correspondent Nick Eardley.
The manifesto published by the Conservative Party today is, in some senses, a safety-first plan. There are pledges not to raise key taxes in the UK and a promise for more staff in the health service. But much of what Boris Johnson is promising voters today is what we have heard from his party since he took power. And at its heart is a promise to deliver Brexit. The manifesto says the Conservatives, if they win power in the election on the 12th of December, will bring key Brexit legislation back to the UK Parliament before Christmas and take the country out of the EU by the end of January. The document also pledges there will be no extension to the transition period, due to end at the end of 2020, after which the UK hopes to have agreed a new trade deal with Europe. Mr Johnson sought to contrast that with the Labour Party, who are offering voters another referendum on a new deal, which they hope to negotiate, and the option of cancelling Brexit and staying in the European Union.
Nick Eardley. Earlier this month, there was further fierce fighting over Gaza, triggered when Israel assassinated a senior militant leader from the Palestinian group Islamic Jihad. These rounds of violence have become almost routine, as have accounts of humanitarian suffering blamed largely on Israel's blockade of the territory. But some young Palestinians have started a website to publicise the human stories behind the news. They are Esam Adwan, Asma Taya and Ahmed El-Katawi. On a recent trip to Gaza, our correspondent Barbara Plett-Usher spoke with them about the recent violence. Ahmed begins the conversation.
I want to live. I want to live like any other human being in the world. This is my right. I want to be respected. I want to have it. And I want to see it like happening in the Gaza Strip. This is my city. I should feel safe in my city. Why would I like walk in the street without feeling safe? I mean, even like the horrific fear I witnessed, I mean, during these 3 days was massive for me. Having like been a victim to the sound of bombing and shelling, I couldn't take it anymore, really. I was scared. I mean, I'm 24 years old, but I was really scared. Yeah.
But trust me, this is not the worst thing that could happen to one who's living in Gaza Strip, who lives the three wars and, you know, a partially fourth one. The worst thing that could happen to you is that you're not feeling fear anymore. Not because of being brave, but because of, like, you have suffered so much. There are so many levels of being empty. Some people here in Gaza Strip, they just want to die because they're suffering so much. At my point, I'm fearless, not because of being brave, but I've seen so much. For them, they are fearless because they have suffered so much. They just want to end it. I believe a lot of people exceeded what they can handle.
My sister-in-law 2 days ago was saying, if they bomb us, they should kill us all, because we don't want anyone to stay and live and keep crying on the others. I told her, no, you all die and I want to live, because I really didn't live. I'm still 20, 23, and I didn't live. I really need to live more so I can maybe find some sense of safety or joy or anything. It also makes me laugh when I see some Israelis comment on our posts on social media saying, you're killing our children, you're terrifying us, you're doing this and that. And they don't get the fact that we're just trying to defend ourselves. They don't get the fact that they every time start this. And when we do the same, or less than the same, because we don't have the same equipment, they cry about it and they tell us that we are violating their human rights, that we are violating the international law. But they don't think about themselves. They are doing the same or worse.
Do you think the Palestinian leadership bears any responsibility? Hamas and Islamic Jihad, they have this doctrine of resistance, for example, that Israel and the international community call terrorism.
Well, for me, I don't support anyone. I think we are all Palestinians, but let me ask you, what do we really have as a choice? What can we do? Do we have equipment? Do we have anything that we didn't try before? Tell me what we can do. What options do we have?
Such response is just a representation, a fine representation of what Gaza is not having, which is life. Also, I would condemn Hamas and the PLO for such division which kills the Palestinians in the first place, especially the people in Gaza Strip. We are responding, we are shooting, we are protesting at the Great March of Freedom because we don't have hope. Israel is a great part of that. The PLO is also part of that. Hamas, ideology of terminating others' existence, they are responsible for that. I'm also, blaming the lack of vision, the lack of, a position that can lead us to move forward with a Palestinian case. They are responsible for that, not the occupation. I know that the occupation is imposing a lot of pressures on those, but they are responsible in that in the first place. They have responsibility. If they cannot do it, then they just should step back and let other people to lead.
What about you? How do you feel about the future, Ahmed?
Well, I remember a report was issued by the UN and they said that Gaza Strip will be uninhabitable by 2020. So 2020 is coming in January. So I'm trying to just to receive the shock when it did or when it comes.
Well, for me, to be honest, I don't think this is going to be the last Israeli attack. So you will never feel safe. So I don't have hope, no. I'm sorry, I don't.
Asma Tyer ending that report from Barbara Platt Usher in Gaza. And we also heard from Essam Adwan and Ahmed El Khatawi. Police in Spain are trying to recover a submarine carrying an estimated 3 tons of cocaine. The submarine has ran aground off the coast of Galicia in the northwest of the country. Danny Eberhardt has the story.
Spanish police have yet to release full details of their operation, but local media are reporting that the two arrested men are Ecuadorians. Galicia's rocky coastline has long been used by smugglers, and it appears criminal gangs are using ever more sophisticated means of targeting lucrative European markets. Investigators are trying to work out if this semi-submersible sailed from South America with its cargo of high-purity cocaine or whether it was transferred at sea. The use of such craft by drug smugglers is not in itself new. In July, the US Coast Guard released dramatic footage of its agents stopping one such vessel in the Pacific.
Danny Eberhardt. A ship with 14,000 sheep on board has capsized in the Romanian port of Midia Navodar. The Palau-flagged vessel, the Queen Hind, is lying on its side a couple of hundred metres from shore. Its crew, reportedly all Syrians, have been safely evacuated. But as our correspondent Nick Thorpe told me, it's unclear how many sheep have survived.
This happened in the late morning hours on Sunday. This was a ship called the Queen Hind, registered actually in the Pacific Ocean on the island of Palau. But this is one of the latest ships carrying live sheep. Romania is the largest exporter of live sheep to the Middle East. And this ship, for unknown reasons at the moment, began to sink in the late morning. It's now lying on its side in the harbour. And as we speak, there's a major rescue operation going on. The crew have been able to get off the boat. They've managed to save 32 of the more than 14,000 sheep on board. But at the moment, in the darkness in the harbour, just north of Constanza, they're trying to right the ship. And it's not clear what's happened to the other sheep so far on the boat.
And there's presumably very little that they can do. That's a lot of sheep.
It's not quite clear whether the sheep are still alive. Pictures I've seen from the harbour show the ship pretty much lying on its side in the middle of the harbour. It had just left the wharf loaded with those sheep for the Middle East, a journey which normally takes 8 or 9 days and has been the target of animal rights protesters before, who've said that sheep are held in overcrowded conditions on those boats. But clearly, in this case, it had set out from the harbour. Animal rights activists say also that the conditions under which those sheep are loaded, that this has been a problem in the past as well.
Nick Thorpe. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.
Capital One has a fresh take on banking. Now you can open a new savings account in about 5 minutes and earn 5 times the national average. Banking with Capital One means 5 times the savings towards your dream honeymoon. or 5 times the savings towards your family's ultimate vacation. Even 5 times the savings towards just feeling good about saving. It's time to make your savings goals come true. This is Banking Reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One, NA member FDIC.